It is Wednesday, December 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, our U.S. political correspondent Jim Malone takes a look at a new poll showing a jump in national support for Republican presidential contender Donald Trump. Rights group Amnesty International talks to us about why it thinks Russian airstrikes in Syria are potential war crimes. And you'll hear a report looking back at Americans of all ages who performed extraordinary acts of giving this year.
Last spring, I had the idea to dress up like a superhero and help the homeless.
It's all ahead on International Edition. A new poll by U.S. TV network CNN shows American tycoon Donald Trump leading the race for the Republican presidential nomination with 39% support. That's 21 points ahead of his nearest rival, Republican Senator Ted Cruz, who's at 18%. For a look at what's behind Trump's continued rise in popularity, I sat down with our U.S. political correspondent Jim Malone, and I asked him what he makes of the CNN poll.
It's interesting that in that poll, Trump has a double-digit lead over Ted Cruz. Now, a poll earlier this week from Quinnipiac had him with a very narrow 4-point lead within the margin of error. It's clear that Trump remains at the top of the field. The lead is maybe a little bit fungible. We don't exactly know, but we do know that for the most part, Trump has not been hurt by a lot of the outrageous comments people focus on. That group of conservative activists within the Republican Party he's speaking to are still with him. The key question will be, once we get to Iowa on February 1st, the New Hampshire primary February 9th, are they going to turn out in numbers to support him at the polls? Because we've had now 6 months of an increase in polling for Trump. He's definitely been able to do that. Will these folks actually come out to vote? That's the next key challenge for him.
Well, what do you think Trump has been saying and doing to enable his poll numbers to keep going up? So in other words, what is connecting with the Republican voter base?
You know, from the start, he has made immigration the focus of his appeal. And I think a lot of us underestimated how powerful that still is with conservative Republicans. They don't want anything that smacks of amnesty, someone who came in the country illegally being allowed to stay or on a path to citizenship. We've seen this play out recently with a debate between Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio over who was on the right side of that issue. So Trump, from the very beginning, the vow to build the wall, he then, of course, expanded that once we got into terror scares with deciding that he proposed a ban on non-American Muslims coming into the U.S. Again, his poll numbers did not go down after that. More generally, among moderates and Democrats, it did. A lot of people don't like that idea. But among Republicans, he still stayed strong. So starting with the immigration base, Trump has been able to catapult off that to continue his strength.
Well, you mentioned Ted Cruz. He is number two in that CNN poll. What do you think the Republican establishment thinks of Senator Cruz? Do you think he is acceptable to them as an alternative to Trump?
Boy, they've really clashed since he came into the Senate. You know, he's a freshman senator. He was only elected a few years ago. And from the start, by the way, even people in Texas thought he would make a run for the presidency. But Ted Cruz has made his reputation on defying Washington, not just Democrats, but Republican congressional leaders, particularly in the Senate. So Cruz is now using this to appeal to the same kind of Trump voters. Hey, I'm a political outsider. I'm not a Washington insider. You can trust me to shake things up. The problem for Cruz down the road is a lot of these institutional Republicans are not in his corner. They're going to be looking for an alternative. The issue with the Republican Party right now, though, is they haven't come up with an alternative yet among Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie.
They're all still way down in single digits, aren't they?
And we won't know probably at least until the New Hampshire primary who will emerge to get into that final lane to challenge the more conservative people like Trump and Cruz.
All right. Well, thank you so much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone, for giving us the lowdown on the latest polls.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Well, let's see what social media are saying now about Trump's rise in the latest polls. For more on that, we have Olin Akosholu with us here in the studio. Olin, what have you got today?
Hi, Michael. Well, across Twitter, the phrase "enough of Trump" has actually been trending for a few hours. It appears to have started with a Washington Post op-ed called "Oy vey, enough of Trump." That was published online last night. But the phrase isn't just from people saying they've had enough of Trump. It's also people saying they can't get enough of Trump. And people have also been quick to point out the irony that a Washington Post op-ed can spark this social media trend, while a cartoon that it published last night, which depicted Ted Cruz and his daughters as monkeys, that caused a lot of people to get upset, and the Post later deleted it.
Yeah, I did see that. Well, how are people reacting to that cartoon on social media?
A few Republican candidates actually came out against the Washington Post cartoon on Twitter. Donald Trump tweeted, "The Washington Post, which is the lobbyist power for not imposing taxes on Amazon, today did a nasty cartoon attacking Ted Cruz's kids. Bad." Marco Rubio tweeted, "Washington Post cartoon featuring Ted Cruz's children is disgusting. The Post saying the kids are fair game is even worse." Ted Cruz actually replied to Rubio's tweet and thanked him for the support. But overall, most people who I've seen tweet about the cartoon are saying the Washington Post has crossed the line.
And they probably feel the same because they did actually remove that cartoon. So what else are political candidates tweeting about today?
Well, if you want to take a quick laugh, have a look at Kentucky Senator Rand Paul's Twitter account. He's celebrating the fictional holiday Festivus, which comes from the American sitcom Seinfeld and takes place today, December 23rd. Part of the holiday involves listing your grievances, and he's doing just that, tweeting out his anger at other Republican candidates and Washington in general. But he's not the only one talking about Festivus. Many Twitter users have been tagging their tweets with hashtag Festivus, and it's become the top trend in the United States.
Well, I wonder what I'm going to list as my grievances for Festivus. Well, let's see about that. Thanks very much, Olin, for joining us today.
You bet, Michael.
This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. A report released Wednesday by rights group Amnesty International says Russia's air campaign in Syria has killed hundreds of civilians and caused massive destruction in residential areas. The rights group claims the pattern of Russian attacks show evidence of violations of international law. Earlier, I spoke to Anna Neistat, a senior director for research at Amnesty, and I asked her how her organization gathered evidence of civilian casualties from the Russian airstrikes.
Well, there were several methodologies that we used. We interviewed witnesses to the attacks. We had to interview them remotely as we couldn't get access to the site, but we interviewed them over phone and internet. We also spoke to activists on the ground who collect this information on a regular basis, as well as doctors. In addition, we reviewed video and audio materials that were collected in the aftermath of the attacks, and then we commissioned military experts to analyze them to determine the nature of destruction and what type of weapons, bombs, or missiles have been used. But probably most importantly, in trying to identify whether the airstrikes were actually Russian, we also compared the strikes that we documented to the statements made by the Russian authorities. So we went through Russian media reports and official statements from the Ministry of Defense, where they claim that they have hit a particular target. And by making this comparison, we're able to make the determination.
Well, Russia says that it is targeting terrorists. So why do you think it would carry out strikes on civilian areas where there aren't any militants, as your report suggested?
Well, why is a difficult question to ask, but what we did document is that in the attacks that we included in our report, we see that either these residential areas were directly hit because there seemed to be absolutely no military targets in the vicinity, and that's five out of six attacks that we documented in detail. And in one case, the attack appears to be disproportionate. So even though there might have been a military target in the vicinity, the civilian damage way was the damage made to the military object. So in most cases, we believe that Russia is not using sufficient care in strikes. But also, we have to remember that Russia has been a long-time supporter of Assad's regime, and Assad's regime and Syrian forces have been killing civilians in thousands on a regular basis over the last 3 years. So I think it's very much in line of what Russia has been seen doing for the 3 years. Just now, they're more directly involved.
Okay, well, thank you very much to Anya Neistat of Amnesty International for speaking to International Edition.
Thank you.
A new survey of Arabs in 12 countries finds that 89% of them are opposed to the Islamic State militant group, also known as ISIS. More than 18,000 Arabs took part in the survey conducted by the Qatar-based Arab Center for Research and Policy between May and September. The center says opposition to the Islamic State group is strong among Muslims who consider themselves very religious, as well as those who say they're secular. But University of Sydney Arab and Islamic Studies Honorary Professor Ahmed Shboul told VOA's Victor Beatty that he's skeptical about the survey's results.
I think on the face of it, it's surprising, but there are problems, I think. For example, I think it could have been better if they had taken the samples proportionally. So you see, to take 1,500 from Egypt and 1,500 from Mauritania is really, there is a lack of proportion here. And also countries which are far away, and understandably, probably would not be as aware, the people would not be as aware of the dangers of ISIS. The other problem, I think, has to do with how much freedom of opinion there is for people to express in such situations in a number of the 12 countries which have been covered by the survey. I don't want to name them, but I think you probably know some of them. And I think the other problem is perhaps it would have been better to ask the question not only about the Islamic State, but to include a question about the other jihadists who are fighting, in particularly in Syria, especially Jabhat al-Nusra and Jaish al-Fatah, the Army of Victory. I say that for two reasons. One, because these groups are reportedly supported by a number of the countries which have been covered by this survey. The other reason why I think is relevant to include them in the survey is that I've watched a video of an interview with one of the leaders of the so-called Army of Victory, Jaish al-Fatah, in northern Syria. And he was saying, you know, to begin with, he loved the ISIS, but there were different in differences about the tactics and strategies. And he was saying, you know, we hope one day there will be some conciliation with ISIS. So these are really big problems.
So you question the methodology of the survey?
Especially the exclusion of other extremists. I can't understand why, because a lot of people are talking about, you know, ISIS as a danger and is being targeted by all sorts of people. I'm not quite sure how serious the powers that be are about actually targeting the causes of the rise of ISIS and also the other groups I alluded to, who are, in fact, almost as dangerous, potentially, at least.
I guess you sense, then, that this does not necessarily reflect the true feelings of people toward Islamic State.
It's good to have surveys. It certainly gives the impression that, look, we have the vast majority of the Arab world who are anti-ISIS, and I hope this is so. I think they will become more anti-ISIS if ISIS is demonstrated to be wrong intellectually, and we haven't done enough about that, as well as if ISIS is defeated on the ground.
Well, that was Ahmed Shboul of the University of Sydney talking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute. A new study that examined more than half of Earth's freshwater supply finds climate change is quickly warming the world's lakes, which is seen as a threat to the supply of fresh water and its ecosystems. Researchers analyzed more than 25 years of data that included temperature and ground measurements of some 235 lakes located throughout six continents. They found that our planet's lakes are warming by 0.34 degrees Celsius every 10 years. And while the noted temperature increase may seem small and insignificant, the scientists say it's bigger than the warming rate of either the ocean or the atmosphere. They say water temperature can affect the health and sustainability of our ecosystems. They add that when there's such a quick and wide shift away from normal lake temperatures, the life forms it supports could change radically and even disappear. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. As 2015 comes to a close, VOA's Julie Tebow looks back at a few caring Americans who have made a positive difference in their communities. They include a pianist, a philanthropist, a group of inspiring young students, and one very special canine.
This past year, VOA introduced you to Serlene Rose, who's been playing piano in the lobby of Sibley Hospital in Washington every Friday for 20 years.
I lost my husband in 1991, and for 5 years I was really, which I say, at loose ends. And I started to get very depressed, and I thought psychologically, if you help somebody else, you help yourself. And that's how I came to Sibley to play the piano.
In March, we met a group of young students whose efforts got them some special recognition from the president.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the second annual White House Film Festival.
These young filmmakers were invited to the White House for a special event honoring their movies. The 15 films screened at the White House Festival shared a common theme, the impact of giving back. There was Superhuman.
Last spring, I had the idea to dress up like a superhero and help the homeless.
And we met a group of second grade students at a school in Boulder, Colorado, in the film We Starts With Me.
How can you make a difference or make things better in the world?
Go work together and help each other. Things could start to change.
And then there was Archer Hadley, whose disability prompted him to raise money for automated doors at his school. Not just for his benefit, but for anyone else who needs them.
I got stuck out in the rain, and that was the inspiration for my project. And I needed to raise $40,000, and I raised over $87,000.
This project is going to help the community for years to come, years and years to come.
2015 was also the year when VOA had a chance to learn firsthand just how generous Americans can be. Billionaire philanthropist David Rubenstein has donated millions of dollars to help preserve American history by funding restoration projects for some of the country's most historic landmarks.
Philanthropy is an ancient Greek word. It means loving humanity. It doesn't mean rich people writing checks. So you can use whatever money you might have, but you can use your time, your energy, your ideas to help your community, your state, or your country.
But doing good work that helps others isn't limited to humans. When disaster strikes anywhere in the world, American search and rescue dogs are among the first to arrive on the scene, helping to look for survivors.
Go fine.
In July, VOA traveled to Lorton, Virginia, to see how special canines like Price are trained to do their jobs.
They're one of the best tools that we have to find unconscious people under the rubble.
Whether through music or film or patriotic philanthropy, caring humans and non-humans alike are using whatever talents and resources they have to help make the world a better place. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
Now for a look at the world of entertainment. The new Star Wars movie that came out last week is not only generating huge revenues from ticket sales, As VOA's Jim Randall reports, The Force Awakens is on course to generate $500 million from sales of toys, clothes, and other merchandise with the Star Wars brand.
Right shoulder. Now up and block, just like I showed you.
Inspired by Star Wars, The Force Awakens, a new generation of young Jedi Knights prepares for battle. It's easier to believe that the Force is with you in your living room if you have the right costume and toy lightsaber.
All righty. There you go.
Retailers like Barston's Child's Play in Washington are armories of the imagination. Steve Ahrens is the owner.
We're going to sell tons of every Star Wars item. Plus, I've seen the movie. I really enjoyed it. And I think that people are just going to be coming back for it for months and years. And they're going to be waiting for that next episode.
One of the largest U.S. toy retailers, Toys R Us, says Star Wars merchandise was immensely popular even before the film came out, with action figures and Lego construction sets among their top-selling toys. Huge online retailer Amazon reports a lot of interest in Star Wars-themed products, including a boost of several 100% in sales of previous films in the series. Disney bought the Lucasfilm franchise 3 years ago and now owns the rights to all Star Wars products. Experts say such products may generate $500 million in revenue. David Weitzner was the brand's marketing chief when the first film came out in 1977.
The film opens and becomes a phenomenon. And all of a sudden, every company that wants to have a product licensed from Star Wars is banging on the door of our merchandising division.
Lightsabers and other toys sell well because they remind people of a movie they enjoyed and the friends who shared the experience, according to marketing professor Janine Buchalter of St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. She spoke via Skype.
So if we're connecting it to that story or we're connecting it to that character, as the fans, then, you know, that's a way, like you said, for us to kind of relive that experience or whatever fun that we had. Or some of it is just about the story, but some of it is also about the social elements around enjoying the story with other people.
Meantime, the young Jedis train hard because, in their imagination at least, they must be ready to confront enemies who are powerful, skillful, scary, and really, really ugly. Jim Rat, VOA News, Washington.
Well, that's a wrap of International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Nick Ivanov. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. I'd like to hear from you on Twitter. You can find me at Michael_Lippin. Be sure to follow this show on Twitter as well. We are at VOA_IE. And we're on Facebook, too. You can like us at VOA Asia. Bye for now.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Even as the world marks the 67th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, China continues to crack down on rights defenders and others who seek to peacefully question official policy and contribute to the public discourse on China's future. Since July, the Chinese government has detained nearly 300 lawyers and activists. The United States has called for the release of more than 20 such people who remain in custody, as well as Ilham Tati, Ken Pokartsi, Zhong Kai, Gao Yu, and Liu Xiaobo. Rights lawyer Pu Jicheng, who was arrested following his participation in a private meeting to peacefully mark the 25th anniversary of the violent suppression of the Tiananmen Square protests, is currently on trial. He stands accused of making criminal comments online, inciting ethnic hatred, and picking quarrels and provoking troubles. Pu Jicheng has been detained since May 2014. The United States mission to the United Nations recently expressed concern with China's national security law. noting that it codifies an expansive and vague definition of national security that invites arbitrary and situational interpretation by security forces. In addition, the United States is also concerned that the government's draft foreign non-governmental management law would unreasonably constrict civil society and undermine people-to-people.